Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's September the 8th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, the dark mass of men were seen. Far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune.
Before we begin, a few housekeeping notes, I guess you'd call them. Now, the first thing I'd like to do, of course, is to thank all of the comrades who attended our Labor Day get-together here in Starbucks and Kurt Cobain land, including some new people I hadn't met before. It was really great seeing all of you. Now, on to another topic that comes up every now and then. A comrade of ours recently had several copies of my Northwest Independence novels confiscated by Canadian Customs when he attempted to enter the country at a border crossing, and they found the books in a routine search of his vehicle. He wasn't arrested or anything, they just kept the books, although I'm sure his name and license number went onto some kind of database and watch list, and he'll be searched a lot more scrupulously in the future whenever he crosses the border. Now, you guys need to be aware that, yes, my books are banned in Canada. Or at least the Northwest Independence novels are. I don't know about The Black Flame or Fire and Rain or any of the other books. I have no idea if this is some kind of blanket ban on everything by Harold Covington or just specific novels. I don't know whether I myself am banned from entering Canada. I haven't had occasion to try recently. I suppose I would simply be refused entry, but there's always a chance I might end up sitting in Ernst Zundel's old cell awaiting rendition to Germany for denying the Holocaust, or rendition to Israel for the crime of being born. Now, if you're Canadian and you want the Northwest Independence books, you can still order them online from Amazon.com and from Barnes & Noble, as well as from general sellers like Libris.com. Apparently, the Canadian regime hasn't bothered to inform online retailers that the books are banned, either because they understand that online sales are almost impossible to restrict, or else more likely, because keeping my work out of white Canadian hands just isn't that great a priority. A number of you have by now completed reading the online version of novel number 5, Freedom's Sons, Volume 1, and you've asked when this novel will become available in actual book form. Well, the answer is, I don't know. Print-per-order publishing costs money to set up, and we have at least one major publishing project that's ahead of Freedom's Sons in the queue. Now, when it does happen, I'll put out a special fund appeal for that purpose, like I always do, but it's not going to be for a while yet. If you guys want a copy that you can actually read and hold in your hands, you can always take the PDF version that I send out for free, and you can print it off on your printers. It'll probably take several ink cartridges, but it can be done. Last week, I asked for MP3 audio files of the late Pastor Richard Butler of the Aryan Nations, one of the founders of the Northwest Imperative. And a number of you complied by sending me such files, especially the famous Race and Reason interview that he did with Tom Metzger around 1984 or so. This is an excerpt from that interview. I'll see if I can get you the whole thing. If not all in one go, then at least in segments over the next few broadcasts. This is a good chance for you folks to hear both Pastor Butler and the show's host, Tom Metzger, in their respective heydays, so to speak.
Today we have Richard Butler, who is pastor of the Church of Jesus Christ Christian sometimes referred to as Aryan nations, and I'd like to welcome you to the show, Mr. Butler.
Thank you.
It's nice to be here,
and it's an honor to be here, Tom.
What is the Church of Jesus Christ Christians, or Aryan Nations? Where can I find it, and what's it all about?
Well, Tom, you can find it here in this room. You can find it all over. Actually, the church word is from ecclesia, which is assembly, and Aryan Nations is nothing more than the nations of the white race existing here upon the face of the earth. So wherever you find white culture heritage, you find part of the Aryan Nation, and whether it exists here in South Africa or in Europe or even in Asia. So we include all of those who are of the genetic heritage of the white race. They are part of the Aryan Nations.
How long has this church been in existence under your leadership?
Under my leadership since 1971. And we started our Idaho branch in 1973.
Would you consider your main base in the Idaho area?
Main base, but we have many congregations throughout Canada, the United States, and even a few in Western Europe.
Now, we see a lot about you on the news lately. It sounds like you have sort of a militant type approach to theocracy or theology.
It is militant, yes, in the sense that we believe that the existence and preservation of our race is our duty before God. And, of course, to our people as well as to ourselves. So we are militant in that sense. And, of course, there were some who took militancy or allegedly took militancy further than what we have advocated. However, I imagine there were people at the time of the signing of the Declaration of Independence were saying the same things about us. The sense of liberty, for instance.
Are you speaking about the order?
Yes, I'm speaking about the order.
Well, were all of the people in the order identity? Or?
No, sir.
I see.
No, there was a few of them who were not. I would say there was probably 11 or 12 of the ones that I've been reading about in the papers who were not identity.
Would you think a phenomenon such as the militant order would have some kind of an example of what may be coming with problems of farmers and so forth? Because it seems that most of these men were working class people. Do you see more and more of this frustration boiling over in this country?
Oh, yes. As I've said before, it's merely a tiny vanguard who came together, but it heralds a greater vanguard yet to come. And I believe that you'll find in the Midwest, and even in our own state of Idaho, where some 60,000 farmers are now in trouble in Idaho, and more of them are now turning to us for answers. In other words, they have heard that there is something to the money situation, the conspiracy, and they're starting to look back to their own roots. We have one who is a leader in Idaho, who is a fourth generation. His family actually pioneered with a covered wagon and settled the land there and cleared the sagebrush and started the farm that is now occupied by Mr. Miller. And now they're beginning to feel the pinch. So there is an explosion coming, and I think, Tom, that if we look back in our own history at the 1776 period, you'll find it was the farmers then, too.
I see in your literature that each year, usually, you have, an Aryan Nation Congress,
that's
and
correct.
People come from around the country and other countries. I mean, what's that all about?
Well, it's like a family gathering, family reunion. We try to gather it all from all over the country to break down the artificial national barriers. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm a nationalist, extreme nationalist, but I'm a racial nationalist. I believe that whether he's French or Swedish or Norwegian or Finnish or Russian or German, he is my kinsman by blood, and of course from Scripture we see this in racial national identity.
Do Aryan Nations, be obviously being a religious organization, people have differences of opinion, obviously, but generally, how do they feel about the way the present system in Washington is working?
Well, generally, they realizing that their enemy is not in Moscow or Peking. It's not in Watts or in Miami. Their enemy resides in the governments of Washington, D.C., or Boise, or Olympia, or Sacramento. We are our own worst enemies.
Seems like there's a lot of people from different groups and individual leaders around the country saying that. And it sounds to me like the central government of this country has created an underclass of people, and they're beginning to get very restless. Does that sound right to you?
That's true.
Well, what would be your position as far as, are you a racial determinist or an economic determinist?
No, racial determinism is my...
I mean, I think we have to define that in this day and age, because 75% of the body politic, all they talk about is economic determinism.
That's right.
And you and many other people are saying, hey, wait a minute, we are not economic determinists. Economic determinism is way down the list, and what?
That's right. You see, everything that creates economics springs from the race and the culture. The race and culture have to exist first. We were racial determinists at the beginning of the formation of what we call the United States of America. I believe we exist under a de facto government of economic determinism now, which is your capitalist that you were talking about. I believe that we fell as a people in 1857, which was the Supreme Court decision which declared the culture and the citizenship of this nation belonged to those who created it, who in the beginning formed we the people. This has been overturned through economic determinism, through the so-called Civil War, or the War Between the States, which set up what we know as capitalism today. If we look back through our history, the robber barons after the Civil War, which set up in the 1890s and so on, is where we are today. And we've been deceived as a people to selling our souls for the dollar.
Hi guys, this is Axis Sally with just a quick rant for you. Harold and I both get a lot of demands that we trot out our crystal balls and tell you all in minute, micromanaged detail, quote-unquote, how we're going to do it. Well, we're not. You're going to do it. Of course, most of you have no intention of ever actually coming here, so you'll miss out on the chance of becoming part of a for-real revolutionary elite. Just a quick recap. First, you need to read the 5 Northwest novels. Those contain the answer to virtually any and every question anyone might have about the Northwest Imperative. Secondly, forget about all this "the Jews won't let us" crap. We do not intend to ask anyone's permission to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. Finally, the entire Northwest Imperative is based on the idea that the federal government of the United States, which is the primary enemy of freedom and of our race, is weak and getting weaker every year. Now, if the obsessive conspiracy nuts are right, and if Zog is indeed this all-powerful, omnipotent, ubiquitous, sees-all, knows-all, plans-all, invincible, and pervasive tyranny that will never change, never die, and is manipulating us all secretly from behind the scenes, then obviously nothing will work and our race and civilization is doomed to perish from the face of the earth. Which in fact seems to be exactly the message so many of us appear to want to convey. I'm not exactly sure why so many of us seem to want to peddle nothing but doom and gloom and despondency and despair, but that's our little movement for you. Most likely it's so that they themselves have an excuse to avoid any risk or inconvenience. We're all doomed, so why bother? You get the idea. But it's pretty clear from ongoing events in the Middle East and elsewhere that my assessment is the correct one, and not the wailing and whining of the doomsayers. Direct resistance is possible. We are seeing it every day on our television screens. Zog is not invincible or eternal. They are getting their asses most righteously whooped while we speak. Furthermore, strong and vibrant bodies politic have no need to pass the kind of oppressive laws we are seeing, like the Patriot Act, in order to protect themselves. They can afford to ignore little guys like Matt Hale and Chester Doles and Edgar Steele, but the Americans don't. The United States government is scared. What does this tell us? Those little barefoot brown hajis with nothing but AK-47s in their hands have one thing we lack: physical courage, pure and simple. That's our missing ingredient, guys. Once we reacquire that, after the revolution, we'll all be amazed at how easy it was.
It's been pointed out to me that there is one white nation that has gotten very little mention here on Radio Free Northwest, and that's the Australians. Now, these people who are pointing this out to me are correct. I haven't spoken too much about the land down under, and that's an omission I need to correct. They are one of the youngest of the white family of nations, and since the Afrikaners voted themselves out of existence, I suppose you might say they're the youngest. I was looking around for some Australian music to play for you, though, and I discovered something I'd kind of noticed in prior years, but for one reason or another, I never really internalized, and that is that, for some reason, most of their music is damn depressing. They're almost as bad as the Irish in that regard, although without the excuse of the lousy weather. Of course, the most famous Australian song of all is Waltzing Matilda, and it almost became their national anthem some years ago when they were having a national debate on the subject. Waltzing Matilda finally lost out to a song called Advance Australia Fair. A lot of people wanted Waltzing Matilda, but someone pointed out that despite its catchy tune, and despite being well-known and associated with Australia, the song actually, if you listen to the words, is about a sheep thief who gets caught and commits suicide to avoid capture and then haunts the place where he died. Well, that's all very poignant and ethnic and all that, but was it really what an entire nation of people wanted to express their national personality and aspirations? I think the Australians had some kind of referendum on it, and even so, that song almost won. Also, for some reason, I, again, can't quite get a read on. They seem to be really short of good folk musicians. And yes, I'm familiar with Slim Dusty. And I say again, the Aussies seem to be kind of short of really good folk musicians. Actors in plenty, true, but very lean in the singing department. One of Australia's national legends lies around the Gallipoli campaign of World War I. When the colony, as it was then, followed the mother country and the mother country's bird-brained, toffee-nosed git officers into a slaughterhouse conceived by that jackass Winston Churchill, trying to capture the Straits of the Dardanelles from the Turks. Now, some of you may have seen the movie Gallipoli, starring Mel Gibson. This is called, and the band played Waltzing Matilda, and it's sung by Makem and Clancy.
Now when I was a young man, I carried me pack, and I lived the free life of the rover. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback, I waltzed my Matilda all over. Then in 1915, my country said, son, it's time to stop rambling, there's work to be done. So they gave me a tin hat and they gave me a gun. And they sent me away to the war. And the band played Waltzing Matilda as the ship pulled away from the quay. And amid all the tears, flag waving and cheers, we sailed off for Gallipoli. Well, I remember that terrible day when our blood stained the sand and the water, and how in that hell that they called Suvla Bay, we were butchered like lambs at the slaughter. Johnny Turk, he was ready, oh, he primed himself well. He rained us with bullets and he showered us with shell. And in 5 minutes flat, we were all blown to hell. Nearly blew us back home to Australia. And the band played Waltzing Matilda when we stopped to bury our slain. And we buried ours, and the Turks buried theirs, and it started all over again. Those who were living just try to survive in that mad world of blood, death and fire. And for 10 weary weeks I kept myself alive, though around me the corpses piled higher. Then a big turkey shell knocked me arse overhead, and when I awoke in me hospital bed and saw what it had done, and I wished I were dead. never knew there were worse things than dying. For no more I'll go waltzing Matilda all around the green bush far and near. For to hump tent and pegs a man needs both legs. No more waltzing Matilda for me. They collected the wounded, the crippled, the maimed, and they shipped us back home to Australia. The armless, the legless, the blind, the insane, those proud, wounded heroes of Suvla. And when the ship pulled into Circular Quay, I looked at the place where me legs used to be, and thanked Christ there was no one there waiting for me. To grieve and to mourn and to pity, and the band played Waltzing Matilda as they carried us down the gangway. But nobody cheered, they just stood there and stared, and they turned all their faces away. So now, every April, I sit on my porch and I watch the parade pass before me. I see my old comrades, how proudly they march, renewing their dreams of past glory. I see the old men, all tired, stiff and sore, the weary old heroes of a forgotten war. And the young people ask, what are they marching for? And I ask myself the same question. And the band plays Waltzing Matilda, and the old men still answer the call. But year after year, the numbers get fewer. Someday no one will march there at all. Waltzing Matilda, Waltzing Matilda, who'll come a waltzing Matilda with me? And their ghosts may be heard as they march by the billabong. Who'll come a waltzing Matilda?
Okay, this is Comrade Charles Martel, and what we're going to do here is we're just going to sit and bullshit for a while on the air.
And if I think of something brilliant to say, I'll just chip in there.
We were talking the other day about this concept that we hear a lot from naysayers and people who don't fancy the Northwest Imperative for some reason, that the Northwest is, quote, full of liberals, quote, unquote. I was reading some post on one of the groups saying, well, I moved to the Northwest and there's liberals under every bush up there, blah, 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 blah. And the thing is, okay, I can see how people might get that impression because of the electoral results and the politics here in Washington and Oregon especially. And I can understand how people might say that because we elect a lot of Democrats in Washington and Oregon especially, but the fact is that it really isn't true.
I agree totally with that. If you're in downtown Seattle, maybe it's super liberal. But once you get out of the environs of Seattle, the people are really, they're really nice people. They're just good old country folks. They may not be espousing our exact ideology, but they pretty well agree with us in general. But mostly they're just good, honest country folks, and they're very welcoming. They're very friendly. And, I mean, this whole idea that the Northwest is full of liberals, I mean, that's just crazy.
Well, we've got three or four large urban areas. Mm-hmm. Seattle, the Pugetopolis, which is a huge area. It extends much beyond Seattle itself, almost all the way up to Bellingham and all the way as far south as Olympia. So that's a very large, very populous area. Then you got Portland, which is, again, a very large city. You've got a couple of places like Eugene, which is the home of the University of Oregon. But these huge cities create a problem for the people in these Northwest states, kind of like what New York City creates for the people in New York State and what Chicago creates for the people in Illinois. These huge cities more or less outweigh and take over and become sort of the public image and the public spokesman, if you will, and they become the face of the region, and it's just not accurate, it's just not correct. Basically, these large cities like Seattle, Portland, Eugene, to some extent, Boise and Spokane, they're the places where all the minorities are. They're the places where all the media concentrate, which is, again, is a liberal power nexus there. They are the places where the political and money power concentrates. And so the result is, because the cities are so much more populous than the countryside, they elect a lot of representatives and whatnot, Democrats, blah, blah, blah. The result is that, technically speaking, Washington and Oregon are blue states. But I can tell you right now that the Democrat Party does not represent the people of the vast, overwhelming majority of Washington or Oregon. It's just these damn cities completely skew the results.
Well, that's exactly true. And it's the same way in every, what I call, rural states, which Washington, Idaho, and Montana, and Wyoming are. They're basically full of people that had their beliefs implanted in the 50s. But they've been overrun. I mean, they haven't been overrun, but the major cities have been overrun by basically liberal executive types from California. I mean, Idaho is a great example. It was an incredibly rural, conservative place back in the old days. And then all of these yuppies who were tired of getting mugged in L.A. or New York decided to move their corporations to Boise. And Boise went from being this little rinky-dink town along the Snake River to this huge metroplex that stretches for like 50 miles along the new freeway. And now Idaho is like one of the most liberal states legally in the United States. And it's all because of all those twits that live in Boise. But the problem is with the economic downturn, all those corporations are pulling out of Idaho. And I'll tell you, the people out in the small towns, they are sick and tired of it. They hate it, and they're glad to see those idiots go back to wherever they came from. And so the point of my diatribe is the Northwest is a perfect place for people to move to, as long as you try to stay out of the major cities, because there you have the same problems everywhere else. You have crime, pollution, crowding, and just the general psychological mayhem of those kind of places. But out in the country, it's what America used to be like 50 years ago.
One of our primary settlement areas is, of course, here in the Puget Sound area. We kind of have to have it here because there are a lot of people, incoming migrants to the Northwest, who are going to have jobs. And the fact is, we have to have a settlement area where there is some kind of economic activity and where incoming migrants can get jobs, can get settled. And that means that we have to target areas where there is at least some economic activity. So to a large extent, that's why we have to concentrate right now in areas like the Puget Sound. But again, the Puget Sound area itself is a wide and varied area. Don't make the mistake of assuming that all of Seattle, even, is liberal and blue state and hippy-dippy and all that sort of stuff. Because, I mean, that may be the impression that the Kurt Cobain grunge rock scene and the Starbucks and all that sort of stuff gives. But again, it ain't necessarily so. When we talk about the so-called liberal establishment in the Northwest, you're talking about a small, empowered, wealthy elite at the top, including a lot of Jews, a lot of homosexuals, etc., who have concentrated in these urban areas, Portland and Seattle, and they've become kind of the establishment. So when you hear all this liberal crap coming out of the Northwest, bear in mind that it's not coming from the Northwest people themselves. It's coming from the empowered liberal establishments in Seattle and Portland. Now, even in these cities, the ordinary white working people are quite conservative. They're increasingly racial in their nature because they themselves are losing their jobs, losing their homes. They see Mexicans in big, huge power trucks rolling by with their salsa music blaring. They clearly have jobs, whereas the local white people don't. So the racial awareness is spreading in the Northwest just like it is everywhere else.
Well, that's for sure. One of the things I was really surprised when I first moved up here was how people were actually, they were willing to talk about politically incorrect things at work. I was actually shocked coming from the, you know, extreme politically correct environment that I come from. I was walking down the hallway and two coworkers were busily going on about the immigration problem. And I just was stunned. I was looking around for the thought police because where I come from, people don't say stuff like that at work. You lose your job in about a second. And I saw that all the time, that people spoke freely, and I kind of jacked them up about it gently. And they just looked at me like I was nuts. It never crossed their mind that they couldn't say whatever they felt like at work. So I actually was pleasantly surprised by the level of, and these aren't people that have our ideology, these are just regular working class white people, and they just felt like they could say whatever the hell they wanted to.
A lot of the migration that we get up here is what we refer to as organic migration. It's ordinary white working people who are just plain leaving various other places around the continent, especially California, just to get away from the Mexicans and the muds and the trash and the general politically correct bullshit. I've noticed one thing about the Seattle area, and this probably applies in some of the other so-called liberal areas of the Northwest as well. In the workplace and on the streets and in the communities, the people are fairly open about their hostility towards illegal immigrants. Of course, virtually all Americans are, but in the Northwest, hostility towards Mexicans and illegals of various kinds is quite common, especially in view of all the migrants that we've gotten from California. Bear in mind, a lot of these people actually came up here to get away from the Mexification of California, but I've noticed that there is still a little bit of a taboo against talking about niggers. Now, talking about niggers is not really cool, it's racist, and we mustn't, you know, be racist and all this sort. So you still get some of that up here. But every workplace I've ever been in the Seattle area, it's always been open season on the Mexicans because, again, a lot of these people came from California and other places where, in essence, the Hispanic illegals drove them out, either economically or through their criminal activity or through the drugs or politically, however it might have happened, or just because basically they just didn't want their kids growing up in a province of Mexico. And this is another thing people don't realize about the Northwest is that there is, in fact, a lot of migration here going on. Most of it having nothing whatsoever to do with us or the Northwest Front. It's mostly just ordinary white working people who want to get away from the crap that politically correct society has created, although, of course, they would cut off their own ghoulies rather than admit that they were racially motivated, and they always use the code words, oh, we got good schools and clean air and, you know, nice communities, and basically all these things are just code words for a very white society. Now, the Northwest is not all white. I have never claimed that, but it is still one of the most white areas remaining in the country, and it's still the place that we're going to have to settle in order to establish our beachhead and create our homeland.
Well, I don't know, Harold. I don't know where you've been hanging out, but where I've been working, you know, living, I mean, they're almost totally white communities. I mean, there's a small percentage of non-whites, but whether I'm going to the supermarket or I'm going to work or the gas station, most people are white here. I was like really stunned myself because I kind of bought into the whole thing that Seattle was a colony of Hong Kong. But I mean, if you go in downtown Seattle, it looks like the United Nations down there, but that's pretty typical of any major city that I've ever been in anywhere in the world. You get out of downtown Seattle, most people here are white.
Yeah. I get the same reaction from people who come up here by airplane. They'll say they land at, say, Portland or SeaTac Airport, and the first thing they notice is all the white people. The non-white population of the Northwest right now is, in theory, greater than it was 15 years ago when I made my first visit to Seattle area, which was like 94. In those days, there were a lot of gooks, not so many niggers at all. Now, especially downtown, you notice like all the cab drivers downtown are Somalis, that sort of stuff. But this is a very small area, and again, it is not typical of all of the Northwest. The percentage, population-wise, of white people in the Northwest is still overwhelmingly in our favor, and it is so much better than everywhere else. People come here from Florida, from New Jersey, from Pennsylvania, from Texas, and the very first thing they remark on when they get in the car after I pick them up at the airport or when they pull up to my place, whatever, is just, my God, all the white people around here. I actually saw a road crew working on the highway as I was coming up, and it actually had white workers. You know, we stopped and we went into a fast food restaurant. And there was white staff, white kids working in a Burger King, you know, which is just something you don't see anywhere else in the country. Yeah, statistically speaking and morally speaking, yeah, things are probably a bit worse now in the Northwest than they were 15 years ago. But still, it's just so much better than anywhere else. And I'll tell you another thing. People sometimes have the attitude that, well, we have to find this perfect all-white place and just everybody move there, and then we can go back to the days of Beaver Cleaver and the Brady Bunch, and we'll live happily ever after. And I can tell you, from having gone to South Africa and Rhodesia in my youth, there is no great white paradise. Those places that I went, South Africa and Rhodesia, were very wonderful in many ways. I would not have missed those experiences for the world. But I can tell you, they were not the great white paradise that we were led to believe from over here. This is why we have to have a Northwest independence movement. We have to create the white homeland from scratch. We are never going to find it anywhere. Now, when you come here to the Northwest, yeah, there's going to be non-whites, there's going to be Jews, there's going to be leftists, there's going to be government problems, there's going to be obstacles to overcome. But this is the place where we have to build our homeland at long last.
Well, the other thing is that I think people are missing the whole point. Even though there are plenty of non-white immigrants here, they do the same thing that we do or everybody else does, and that is ethnic or racial groups tend to cluster together. That's why they're races. There wasn't any racism, there wouldn't have been any races. And so no matter where you go, you see the same thing. You travel all around the United States, and they brought in people from all over the world for this multicultural craziness. And what they want to do is they want to dilute out all cultural groups to destroy their power. But the problem is it's not working. I mean, whether you got some, you know, Somali desert tribesmen or some college professors from Hong Kong or someplace, they do the same dang thing here they do in their own country. That they cluster together. And white people are doing the same thing. No matter where they are, they tend to cluster together because that's what people do. They feel comfortable in their own environment around people that look like them, have the same beliefs. I mean, even white people subdivide into clusters. The liberals like to hang around each other so they can feed into each other's craziness. And just regular old white people like to hang around with other regular old good old boys because we feed into each other to our own brand of craziness.
Well, this is why I'm advocating creating communities here in the Northwest of white nationalists who live within half an hour's drive of each other. Right. And it won't take many. I think that when the word gets out that there is a place that white people can go where you can actually find real people, not just email addresses, not just websites, but real actual people living in communities and getting together and actually meeting with one another on a regular basis. Once that word gets out, we're going to hit a sort of a tipping point, and all of a sudden, we will finally see those migrants coming here. Okay, time for another depressing Australian folk song. You know, if all of their music is this much of a downer, then I can kind of understand why they drink. You know, Australians have a reputation as being really bad boozers. I've never been there, so I can't really say how much of that is justified. I do remember one story that my New Zealand girlfriend told me once, although of course New Zealanders aren't quite the same as Aussies. Apparently back around the days beginning in World War II, when they wanted to try and restrain the Australians from, you know, getting drunk all the time for war production or whatever, they passed a law stating that public bars in the famous Australian hotels, etc., etc., had to close at 6 o'clock at night. And then after the war ended, they kept this law on the books for many years, up until, you know, the 1960s. And the result was a tradition in Australia called the 6 o'clock swill, wherein people would leave work at 5 o'clock and they would rush to the nearest hotel bar. See, in Australia, most of the pubs are in hotels. They're called the Victoria Hotel, something like that, even though it's not really a hotel, it's a pub. But anyway, that's the way they do it. And all these guys would go rushing out at 5 o'clock from their workplace, rushing to the nearest bar, and try and see how much beer and booze and spirits they could pour down their gullet in the hour before the bar closed. And I think we can all imagine the results. And supposedly, one effect of that is to this day, if you go around certain parts of Australia and you go into some hotel public bar, something that was around back in those days, you'll notice that the floor and the walls are made out of these porcelain, like bathroom tiles. And that's because in the old days of the 6 o'clock swill, after the barman finally was able to throw all the drunks out at, you know, 10 past 6 or however long it took him to get him out of the bar, he would then take a hose which he had hanging on the wall, and rather than just try and, you know, clean the place up, he'd just hose the whole bar down and wash all the vomit and the spilled beer and the blood and the guts and the puked up curries or whatever down a drain. It was kind of like a slaughterhouse or a locker room shower, something like that. Anyway, that's the 6 o'clock swill, another fine old Australian tradition. And I'm sorry if that sounds like I'm running the Aussies down. That's not my intention. I know that they're very proud and independent and I think a fascinating people and a fascinating country. But I have to admit, they do have a bad reputation as boozers, and that may or may not have some kind of cause and effect relationship with the fact that, like I mentioned before, a lot of their music I've found is just depressing as hell. Anyway, here's another depressing Australian song.
For nearly 60 years I've been a cocky of droughts and fires and floods. I've lived through plenty. This country's dust and mud have seen my tears and blood, but it's nearly over now, and now I'm easy. I married a fine girl when I was 20, but she died in giving birth when she was 30. No flying doctor then, just a gentle old black gin. But it's nearly over now, and now I'm easy. She left me with 2 sons and a daughter and a bone dry farm whose soil cried out for water. So my care was rough and ready, but they grew up fine and steady. But it's nearly over now, and now I'm easy. My daughter married young and went her own way. My sons lie buried by the Burma Railway. So on this land I've made me own, I've carried on alone. But it's nearly over now, and now I'm easy. City folks these days despise the cocky, say with subsidies and all we've had it easy. But there's no drought or starving stock on a Seward suburban block. But it's nearly over now, and now I'm easy. For nearly 60 years I've been a cocky of droughts and fires and floods. I've lived through plenty. This country's dust and mud have seen my tears and blood, but it's nearly over now, and now I'm easy. And now I'm easy.
time for the grim and serious part of the show, and this will be a bit grimmer and more serious than usual. Now, from now on, I'm going to begin including regular segments on Radio Free Northwest dealing with the subject of direct action to bring about change in American society, up to and including what I term the non-consensual replacement of the existing government of the Pacific Northwest with a sovereign and independent white homeland. Yeah, the time has finally come to talk about that. I will designate these segments of the show as Brandenburg Lectures, after the landmark Supreme Court ruling which makes them possible, Brandenburg versus Ohio. Now let me explain what I mean by that. In 1969, the United States Supreme Court issued a ruling called Brandenburg versus Ohio, which stated that public discussion of proactive alternatives to the current electoral system do, in fact, constitute constitutionally protected free speech and are not actionable. To make a long story short, Brandenburg versus Ohio is the reason William Pierce was able to write and publish the Turner Diaries, and the reason that I've been able to write and publish my Northwest novels without ending up in prison for the crime of upsetting and annoying people with power. Now, what happened was, back in the 60s sometime, an old-time Klan man, Clarence Brandenburg, got a bit impassioned at a cow pasture rally and made some rather strong and pointed remarks with regard to what needs to be done to federal government officials who plot to destroy the white race and Western civilization and do harm to white children through race mixing, school integration, and other forms of genocide. Something about how such people deserve to die, which of course they do. Brandenburg did not name anyone or threaten anyone in particular. He basically just said that those who betray their country and their oaths of office, not to mention every standard of human decency by taking money from the United States government in order to do harm to children, deserve to die, which is hardly a sentiment confined to us wicked right-wing extremists. Some reporters and a local television station were present at the Klan rally. They recorded and broadcast Clarence Brandenburg's speech, and he was subsequently arrested and prosecuted under an Ohio law against something called, quote-unquote, criminal syndicalism, whatever the hell that is, but which, among other things, prohibited the incitement and advocacy of overthrowing the government of the United States by force and violence. Now, you will notice that I did not say the lawful government of the United States, since nothing that government has done has been truly lawful or constitutional for a long, long time. Not since 1861, in fact. Anyway, the eventual result was the landmark Supreme Court ruling I just mentioned, Brandenburg versus Ohio, which ruling basically affirmed that theoretical and philosophical discussion of the pros and cons of direct action in order to bring about change in American society, i.e. shooting the thieving motherfuckers who rule us in the head, wiring bombs to their cars and blowing their scaly asses to pieces, hanging them by their wretched necks and watching them kick and piss and crap in their pants while they die, anyway, that kind of thing. Theoretical discussions about all of those consummations devoutly to be wished, as Shakespeare put it, is legal and constitutionally protected speech under the First Amendment. Of course it is. How does anyone think the First Amendment and this entire country came into being in the first place? Before the Minutemen stood against the Redcoats at Lexington Green and Concord Bridge in 1775, first, there were all those long and boring speeches and pamphlets and committees of correspondence and so forth that American students used to study in history class before the real American history was replaced in the curriculum with politically correct horseshit. It would have been rather difficult for the Supremes to rule otherwise, in view of the fact that some of the most famous bits and pieces of real American history, of the kind that used to be learned by school children beginning at about the third grade, were in fact speeches and writings by the Founding Fathers before they became Founding Fathers, clearly advocating armed military resistance against the British Crown and violent disobedience against British laws, some of which writings and utterances led directly to acts of insurrectionary violence, such as the Boston Tea Party, attacks on British customs officials, the burning of British revenue cutters, this kind of thing. Now, today, we regard the writing and speeches of men like George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Paul Revere, and John Adams as mere windbag blathering in a language that we can no longer understand. In their day, those words that they spoke and wrote got men killed, and fell into the legal and moral category of what our lords and masters today refer to as terrorism. If the Founding Fathers were alive today, the Joint Terrorist Task Force would be listening to their podcasts and intercepting their emails. For example, there's Patrick Henry's famous Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death speech on the floor of the Virginia House of Burgesses. There is Thomas Paine's Common Sense and the Rights of Man. And there are the writings of men like Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and John Hancock, all of whom openly discussed the desirability and feasibility of warfare with the crown in order to secure American freedom. And I mean with muskets and cannon, not votes in a silly little box. These speeches and writings led to the formation of the Minutemen, who eventually kicked off the shooting phase of the Revolution. Indeed, the entire Declaration of Independence would probably be considered hate speech today because of its negative racial comments about the Indians, and definitely it would be considered incitement to violence today. That's if certain liberal Democrats had their way. And anyone attempting to post the rights of man to YouTube or Facebook would probably have their accounts canceled, which is essentially what happens to us every day. There are a lot of people in the federal government of the United States today working in various capacities who are afraid that our modern-day versions of free speech, either in my Northwest novels or on the internet or on YouTube, might kick off the shooting phase of a second American Revolution, might remove them from power, might take away their wealth and their luxury lifestyles, and expose them to punishment for what they've done. And they're right. It's possible. Not likely. Personally, I think if the white man was ever going to actually do anything, we would have done it by now. But so long as there is genuinely free speech on the internet or anywhere else, in the present confused and chaotic conditions in the world, the risk of actual change is always there. The tinder is so dry that there's always a chance that the spark will catch. Now, it is not totally out of the realm of all possibility that what happened in Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, and Greece might happen here. There's always the chance, however far-fetched, that someday some of you might decide to listen to me, or to someone like me. Now, by that, I do not mean just sit there in front of the computer, gawking at the monitor with your ears flapping in the breeze like a dog with his nose out a car window. By listen to me, I mean that you actually do the things I tell you have to be done in order to secure the existence of our people and the future for white children. Now, this means that the bureaucrats and the FBI special agents, the politicians, the legislators and the lobbyists, the media people, the cable news talking heads, the spin doctors and consultants and think tankers and direct mail fundraisers and all the other 101 other kinds of people who have grown fat and arrogant off this system. Sorry, I know, I'm raving. Where was I? The fact is that while there is a vestige of true free speech remaining in white hands anywhere, these goddamn scum who lord it over us can never really rest completely comfortably at night next to their liposucked wives on their sleep-numbered mattresses in their suburban split levels in Falls Church or McLean, or in their townhouses in Georgetown. These sons of bitches in the $2,000 suits may have 6- and 7-figure bank accounts. They may have certificates of deposit out the wazoo. They may drive a brand new Lexus every year. But so long as there is freedom of speech that they cannot silence by force, the possibility is always there that this junky little 14-year-old computer of mine sitting here on this table can take away everything they have. And thanks to Brandenburg versus Ohio, I can at least give it a shot. Or at least until such time, of course, as the FBI and the Joint Terrorism Task Force decides to simply disregard their own laws and start arresting and prosecuting people for their thoughts. Or until they decide to punt by fabricating an audio tape wherein I am overheard hiring a hitman to assassinate Barney the Dinosaur. So, as you can imagine, our lords and masters are no fans of Brandenburg versus Ohio. They really would like for it to be overturned and disappear. The regime is constantly pushing the envelope, looking for some workaround to bypass Brandenburg versus Ohio. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, the FBI arrested a young Muslim man for uploading a video to YouTube, which they claimed showed violent acts in support of some so-called terrorist group in Bumfuckistan that nobody's ever heard of. Their evidence consists of an allegation, possibly provable, possibly not, that this young man who uploaded the video to YouTube actually met and spoke with the Muslim group leader's son for a few minutes many years ago. Wow, I mean, that's just proof positive. But you see their problem. The FBI and the Joint Terrorism Task Force want to silence this young man's speech, just like they want to silence mine, so they can get a little gold star on their forehead from Washington and maybe a promotion to D.C. or New York or Houston, where they can live in some of the few remaining ritzy suburbs and be among the last people to get a slice of the American dream before it dies. But so long as there is Brandenburg versus Ohio, they're hampered by this constant necessity to come up with some kind of evidence that the person they're targeting for victimization has actually done something. That can be a real bitch, especially when the guy, like me, isn't doing anything other than speaking his mind. Anyway, I've decided I'm tired of circumlocutions and beating around the bush and what Lenin referred to as Aesopian language, the language of fable. Brandenburg versus Ohio may not be around much longer. Like I've said, I'm sure the Justice Department is doing everything they can to get the ruling overturned, or at least to gut it in practice, as when they busted the Muslim for uploading the YouTube video, or when they arrested that poor kid off NewSaxon.org for writing the poem that Obama didn't like. The vibes I'm getting are such that I figure I'd better make use of Brandenburg versus Ohio while it's still technically in force. So, folks, it's time to drop the second most powerful of the two remaining taboos we have in the movement. Now, the first taboo is, of course, the ban on naming names of those among us posing as leaders who are incompetent, dishonest, sexually perverted, active enemy agents, dumb as a bag of hammers, or some combination of all of the above. We can talk vague generalizations about character, but if I so much as whisper one name, all of a sudden, Wicked Harold is undermining white unity and fighting a feud, and we can't have that now, can we? Kidding aside, people, it really is time for the second taboo to go. We must break and overturn the taboo that we have imposed on ourselves for the past 50 years, and that's the taboo against talking about the one thing that will, in fact, bring about genuine change in American society. Now, for the benefit of all the FBI and Joint Terrorism Task Force people who are cupping their hands around their ears and leaning down to their computers waiting for me to say something that they can use to kick in my door, I'll save you some time. First off, in about 3 years' time, if you guys can wait that long, I'm going to be a criminal. I'm going to be breaking federal law. I am not going to be able to afford to buy Obamacare. Now, you guys may think I'm messing with you. You may think I'm trying to be funny. No, I'm not. I'm going to be like many millions of Americans. Come 2014, I'm going to be a criminal because the government in Washington is going to be telling me to do something and I'm not going to do it. I mean, I can't. I've actually looked at the prices for the preliminary version of Obamacare we've got in Washington State and I can't afford it. I'm not going to have the money, but that's neither here nor there. The fact is that as of 2014, when Obamacare kicks in, I'm going to be not doing something that Obama tells me to do. So I'm going to be breaking a federal law. If you guys can just wait 3 years, you can arrest me then, and I'll be guilty. You won't have to make up any tapes of me trying to hire a hitman to blow up the moon or whatever ridiculous story you're going to come up with. I'm sorry, I'm babbling now. Anyway, you get the idea. Now, look, as far as these Brandenburg lectures go, I'm not going to threaten anybody specifically. Yes, I know that's where Bill White and Hal Turner fucked up. Now, this is not to keep my ass covered. I'm not saying this because I have any respect for the laws of the uncouth third world thug who signs your paychecks. Or I suppose I should say your direct deposit slips. I won't be threatening anybody because it wouldn't do any good. I'm not under any illusion that I have some kind of secret army of winged monkeys out there ready and waiting to do my violent bidding. Believe it or not, I really am somewhat, at least, in touch with the real world, certainly more than Obama seems to be. No one is going to follow my lead and rise up in arms and overthrow your government that pays you those direct deposit slips. Would it were so. Would it were so. I'm just going to do what I can do as one man with the tools I've been given to work with, to resist what this regime and this society is doing to the world. History and our very racial survival demand that the penultimate taboo on discussion of direct action has to end, and not just in my novels. Brandenburg versus Ohio gives me a legal fig leaf to speak the truth about what I really think and believe, for a while anyway, until the regime can find some way around it or simply decides to ignore it. This is America. I shouldn't need a legal fig leaf. I should not require the approval of 9 old swine in black robes sitting on a bench in Washington, D.C., drawing way too much taxpayers' money and salary to exercise a right that is guaranteed to me by the United States Constitution. But this isn't really America anymore, is it? This is Barack Hussein Obama's America, and the law of the Founding Fathers has become the law of the jungle. Anyway, from now on, I will call these particular segments on Radio Free Northwest the Brandenburg Lectures. Before I give you my first one, though, here's the only non-depressing Australian song I was able to dig up. This is Rolf Harris.
There's an old Australian stockman lying, dying. And he gets himself up onto one elbow and he turns to his mates who are gathered round and he says, "Watch me wallabies feed, mate. Watch me wallabies feed. They're a dangerous breed, mate. So watch me wallabies feed all together now.
Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down. Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down.
Keep me cockatoo cool, curl. Keep me cockatoo cool. Oh, don't go acting the fool, curl. Just keep me cockatoo cool all together now.
Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down. Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down.
And take me koala back, Jack. Take me koala back. He lives somewhere out on the track, Mac. So take me koala back all together now.
Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down. Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down.
And mind me platypus duck, Bill. Mind me platypus duck. Oh, don't let him go running amok, Bill. Just mind me platypus duck all together now.
Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down. Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down.
Play your didgeridoo, blue. Play your didgeridoo. Like, keep playing till I shoot through, blue. Play your didgeridoo. All together now,
tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down. Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down.
Tan me hide when I'm dead, Fred. Tan me hide when I'm dead. So we tanned his hide when he died, Clyde, and that's it hanging on the shed all together now.
Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down. Tie me kangaroo down, sport. Tie me kangaroo down.
By the way, I remember listening to that particular Rolf Harris song on the radio when I was a child, and I very distinctly remember that in the original 1960s version, there was a verse in there that went something like, "Let me ebbos go loose, Lou, let me ebbos go loose. They're of no further use, Lou, so let me ebbos go loose." I noticed when I went to download that song off Amazon.com a couple of days ago, that verse has now disappeared off the track. A little bit of politically correct censorship from down under there. Okay, my introduction to the whole subject of the Brandenburg Lectures on Radio Free Northwest ran a little longer than I had expected, so I do not, in fact, really have the time left to do one up for you good and proper in this episode, so let's just kind of wing it. A lot of people, I'm sure, are wondering out there whether I've lost my mind. No, not my mind, just my patience. At long last, maybe 40 years too late, I have finally lost patience with being constantly forced to lie to you people by omission. Now, the simple fact is that for donkey's years, anybody in the movement with two brain cells to rub together has understood that nothing we have been doing will ever accomplish a single damned thing by way of actual change. It is a simple and demonstrable historical fact that the only time the tide of, oh hell, what do I call it? The only time the tide of all this crap has ever been halted, even temporarily, it's been through some episode of forcible resistance. Now, you can watch Mississippi burning all you want, but the fact is that for the next 6 or 8 years, after those three toads and that bubble-lipped monkoid Medgar Evers got whacked, all of those damn New York Jews and the so-called freedom riders stayed the hell out of Mississippi. Now, that's something that stupid movie never tells you. Forsyth County, Georgia, Marquette Park in Chicago, some other places. I don't want to go into details, but the only reason that those areas stayed white as long as they did was because of certain events that took place after dark. But defending ourselves and our communities simply isn't enough anymore. The filth still spews off the television, year after year, generation after generation. The jobs are still outsourced to India. The Mexicans pour in their hordes. There's still nobody to vote for on election day except a choice between corrupt Democrats and inept Republicans. And the men who remember enough of the old ways to do what has to be done are now dead or in their 60s and 70s. Now, the order might have done some good eventually, but they weren't allowed enough time to do it in, largely because of mistakes that they made, which were avoidable and which might have been avoided had we not all been so shit-scared to at least be honest and open among ourselves about what was needed. Now it's too late for the defense of the old. Somehow we have to bring the new into being. The balloon may or may not go up, as we say, but I can tell you this. The long, slow collapse is now beginning, and this time the system will not recover. There will be no more $1.29 a gallon gasoline. There will be no more trips to Six Flags. There will be no more American dream. There may or may not be a cataclysmic event, one big definable crash where historians of the future millennia will be able to say, this was it, this was the year and the date when America went down. Or maybe not. If I had to guess, I'd say it's going to be the slow death of an old, old man who has spent his entire lifetime abusing his body and wasting his time and resources. And at long last, the bill comes due, as every day something else goes wrong in America, and every year, life on this continent for white people just gets a little bit worse. And eventually, the old man dies in his chair in front of the TV, and by the time he's found, the rats or his own cat or dog has eaten his body. Most likely, that's how the United States of America is going to die. Nobody will even realize it's dead for a long time after the machine finally shuts down for good. Kind of like a lot of us old white boys. Now, don't get me wrong. However it happens, this will be a good thing. It is time, more than time, for the United States of America to vanish from history. But I really would like to try and save something from the ruins and manage the death of America as best we can. A controlled descent, so to speak. So that the white race and some of what we've created survives the next few centuries, which are going to be pretty hellish for the whole world. Now, in order for that to happen, the present power structure has to fall, one way or the other. And we white men are going to have to make up our minds to be part of that process, or else just hapless victims who get buried under the rubble. The very first thing we have to do in order to save ourselves and save something of our world has to be what they call in Alcoholics Anonymous a fearless and searching moral inventory of ourselves. And that means we stop lying to ourselves and to other men of our race as to what it's going to take to make sure that something survives. With 22% real unemployment and two lost wars in the past decade and a nigger in the White House to boot, we no longer have the luxury of pretending that none of this is happening. Now, that's why I'll be giving these Brandenburg lectures I speak of. I've always wondered what would happen if ever I could get an audience, even a small one like this, and instead of the usual waffle about the Jewish world conspiracy and sending out endless clippings around describing black and brown atrocities against white people and, oh, look how bad it is, look how horrible it is, oh, look what they're doing to us now, blah, blah, you know, the usual right-wing shtick. Instead of that, suppose I stand up and say exactly what's on my mind. No more waffling, no more evasion, no more code words, no more bullshit. This society has developed an almost intolerable aversion to truth. In Obama's America, truth is toxic. I have no idea how long I'll last before they find some excuse, any excuse to shut me up. But it's time I finally did my duty. All of it. So I guess I'm about to find out. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha on the Bond. Freedom.